Welcome. I'm Avery.
And I'm Grace Ann. And this is Drift, a podcast exploring stories and science of Barnegat Bay's past, present, and future.
Let's talk smack about jellyfish. Hey Avery, did you know that a group of jellyfish is called a smack?
I actually didn't know that, Grace Ann. And this is true. They've been using this word around the office, and I didn't know what it meant. I assumed it was a group of jellyfish, but now here on this podcast, I'm learning that that's the real name for it.
That is fantastic. There have been too many smacks of jellyfish invading Barnegat Bay for many years now, but Save Barnegat Bay has partnered with the very best groups in New Jersey to help address our jellyfish problem. And as fascinating and as beautiful as they are, the majority of the species you all have been hearing most about around town are pests and invasive species. But before we get too far, Avery and I couldn't do this episode without our colleague and coworker, Jellyfish Education Coordinator, Brittany McLaughlin.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for having me on today. Before we dive in, I just want to make it clear that today we're specifically talking about bay nettle jellyfish, which are easily mistaken for their very close relative, the sea nettle. But we are going to talk all about that in just a moment.
We kind of accidentally made November Jellyfish Month here at Save Barnegat Bay, but it works out perfectly. October was Rally Month, which is, of course, another one of our ongoing projects. Over the summer, we did a lot of everything, but now it's time for us to focus on our jellyfish project. And a quick aside, you can check out the Barnegat Bay Book Club this month. We're reading Spineless by Julie Burwald, who has agreed to jump on a Zoom and meet our members on November 22nd. So we invite you to tune in for that and continue on this jellyfish conversation. But this Saturday, though, a very exciting thing is going to take place. So I'm going to turn it over to Brittany. Why don't you let our listeners in on our big surprise and what we're doing this weekend?
It is really exciting. We are finally putting the shovel in the ground, or should I say the brushes to the bulkhead. You'll get all these puns as you listen further into the podcast, I promise. If you will, and beginning the scrubbing of bulkheads in Berkeley Shores lagoons to rid the surface of jellyfish polyps. There is so much work that we did to get to this point, so let's rewind and meet some of our partners that are integral members in our Stop the Sting campaign.
First up, we have Dr. John Wenick, who leads a team of high school students and Save Barnegat Bay student grant recipients through preliminary water quality research in the lagoons of concern in Berkeley, Toms River, and Bricktown. So I'll hand it over to you, John.
Yeah, thank you. I represent the Marine Academy of Technology and Environmental Science, and I also oversee the Barnegat Bay student grant program. So we have a collaborative effort with high school students and college students working together to look at water quality issues surrounding areas that have jellyfish or bay nettles, as we refer to them. This past summer, we had two college students who worked in the areas around Berkeley Township up in Toms River, and then they had a control area where we know that there is a known population of jellyfish down in the Lacey area. And then we go out on a weekly basis and sample the level of salt, you know, that may be more conducive for these jellyfish to be found. They also sampled for oxygen, and they put in what they call data loggers to record temperatures in these areas called lagoons, or these open areas that channel back where boats kind of dock up to, and people have waterfront properties that have that walled area that could be vinyl, sometimes wood. And what happened was we found that there was a difference in the temperatures in those back areas versus the front areas closer to the bay as expected. This is important too, because those areas in the back that don't flush as well provide good habitat, less flow, and sometimes the nettles could get stuck in that area. And what happens is that's an area that we kind of look at as this project moves forward. And one of the things that we're trying to do is relate these water quality parameters to the population. So we're focusing on some of those key areas overall.
Yeah, and this is really exciting that we can marry the research and initiatives as part of this project with the younger generation of science stewards and researchers. So we're excited that you're on this project with us and leading that charge. So thank you for being here.
Well, thank you. And our mates jellyfish team, or we call them the bay nettle team, is a high school group of students that works with the college students, and they're excited to be involved in this project as well and make a difference for the community. So thank you for letting us be involved.
You are such a huge part of our whole team. And I just want to get into a little more of the nerdy stuff, if you can go into it a little bit. Sure. What are some of the parameters that, in more detail, that you're looking at that the students are going out, and what kind of tools are they using, just to give our listeners a little bit more of a visual of what it means to test water quality?
Yeah, well, besides the students going out and sampling, some of the high school students will take the samples from the field back to the laboratory, and then they'll look at different parameters like how cloudy the water is. We call that turbidity. They'll measure the chlorophyll in the water, which means that there's some algae or sometimes plants in the water, and they have chlorophyll, and that's how they are active. In other words, sunlight kind of generates their ability to take carbon dioxide in and produce oxygen. But at the same point, too much algae is not a good thing. So throughout the summer season, our students are able to monitor the algae count by looking at chlorophyll, by taking samples back to the lab and using a special meter that kind of measures the chlorophyll content in there. They also looked at something that's a little bit more unusual to projects that involve jellyfish. They were looking at some type of relationship of bacteria in those lagoonal areas that don't flush as well versus those that are near the bay itself, to see if that lack of flushing will also negatively impact water quality, where you'll have higher bacteria levels. And one of the things that make jellyfish a little bit more resilient is the fact that they can live in some of those conditions that are not suitable for a lot of other fish species or other smaller invertebrate species to live. So having those determinations, or us making those measurements, we could, you know, look at the habitats that are maybe not as conducive for other things to live. But if we find the jellyfish or bay nettle population there, that might be an advantage for the bay nettles, and a place that we need to concentrate on. So our students did a lot of that work in the laboratory, and we're grateful for the time that they gave this summer to do that. There were about 10 to 12 students at any time that were on this team that represent the MATE school where I work at, and they worked along with the college students, like I said, throughout the summer months to really make a good determination in the laboratory about some of these water quality parameters that I talked about.
So when a drop of water falls from the sky and lands on the ground, it's often landing on what's called an impervious surface, or a surface that doesn't allow water to pass through it, i.e. our roads and sidewalks, roofs and parking lots. And that water then goes to our storm drains, which goes out into the bay. And that water is a vehicle for nutrient pollution, which ends up going into Barnegat Bay, carrying all of the perfect cocktail of ingredients that makes the jellyfish population really thrive.
So this can all sound really overwhelming, and we do not have to tell our listeners that jellyfish are a real pest for swimmers and lovers of the Barnegat Bay. Not only can they sting us, but they also eat everything in sight.
It makes sense that the back lagoons on the west side of Barnegat Bay are low oxygen, high turbidity, and often low flow. They suffer from intense pressure of nutrient pollution carried through their local storm drains that collect rain from all over the town and discharge it into the bay. The water quality decreases and jellyfish take hold. Here to tell us more about this process is Dr. Paul Bologna from Montclair State University. He's been studying jellyfish as well as other plankton and grasses in Barnegat Bay for over 20 years.
Hi, great to be here. One of the questions that I always get is, you know, why are there so many jellyfish in Barnegat Bay and in our areas? One of the big critical points is that jellyfish survive under the worst of conditions. They're incredibly simple. And so when there's not a lot of oxygen, they do just fine. Fish, invertebrates, all kinds of other organisms do not. And so jellyfish kind of win by default this process. And so in their life cycle, there's a couple of different stages that are really important. So jellyfish have, they call it a biphasic, means that there's two parts to their life. One, there's the adult medusa. This is what we typically think of a jellyfish. But the other critical stage is called the polyp. And polyps live on, naturally, things like oyster shells and any sort of rocks. These are the structures that this really small part of the life history of a jellyfish survives. And it's at this stage that they do an incredible amount of cloning themselves. So they sort of like split and grow, and they continue to clone themselves time after time. And so one individual larva that comes from some adults can settle onto a dock or a bulkhead. And by the end of the season, it might be 10 or 20 individuals as they clone themselves. And this is the stage that survived the winter. And next spring, make the next round of jellies that we see swimming in the ocean, in our bays, in our lagoons, and they make it very difficult for people to enjoy the water.
So, Paul, we know that everyone is wondering about the Oyster Creek Nuclear Power Plant. Can you talk briefly about the different species of jellyfish in the Northern Bay, the Southern Bay, and how the power plant might be affecting where those populations are moving and thriving?
Well, with the closure of the plant, a couple of things are possible, and we're studying these things. One, when the plant was in operation, it sucked up a lot of water, but it sucked up a lot of the sort of baby jellyfish. We call these ephyra, really small individuals that have just come from one of those little polyps. And they really don't swim well. And essentially what can happen is they were probably sucked up into the power plant and killed. So that was a good thing. It got rid of a lot of little jellies. Now that the plant is offline, those same jellies don't have that sort of depth. And so what we might expect to see in the next couple of years is an increase in particular, the bay nettle in that area of Barnegat Bay between Forked River and Oyster Creek, as those small jellies are not sort of sucked into the plant. What that might mean is that in future years, if we don't address that polyp problem, there's going to be more adults and they're going to create more larvae. And it means that other places in the bay, especially the southern part of the bay, might in fact see increases in bay nettles as the adults kind of move out from that area. So the expectations are that jellies might actually increase with the closure of the plant. But if we take active measures, maybe we can minimize that problem.
And while I'm thinking of it, can you, Paul, go over the slight differences between the jellyfish species that we see most often, like the bay nettle, the what's confused for the sea nettle, and then just quickly the comb jelly, because those tend to be the ones that everyone identifies to us kind of on the street.
Sure. So, you know, in Barnegat and in our coastal areas, we have sort of two major jellies, one of which is called the bay nettle. It used to be called the sea nettle, and it was lumped into the sea nettles, which live sort of offshore along our coast. But this is a different species that likes low salinity waters, and that's why we see them so abundant in Barnegat Bay and other some of the other estuaries in New Jersey. One of the other sort of gelatinous zooplankton, the jelly-like creatures that we get out here, are called comb jellies. And comb jellies are fascinating. They are bioluminescent. So at night, if you kind of jostle the water, they'll glow green. They have these big rows of cilia. So when you look in the water, it looks like it's a rainbow of them sort of swimming through. Those are not true jellyfish. Those are a different group of organisms. They don't have stinging cells, but they are voracious predators, the same as a regular jelly. So they do eat a lot of things like larval fish and fish eggs. So they can have an impact on the other species in the bay. We also have a handful of other jellies that we see on a regular basis, lion's mane. Lion's mane can actually get really large. And what I mean by really large, 4 or 5 feet in diameter with tentacles 20 feet. We don't tend to see those sizes in New Jersey, but we have bowling ball jellies. And then we also have some other not so nice little friends, the clinging jellyfish, which is an invasive, but lives in the grass beds and lives in vegetation. And those are newly found in New Jersey. They're only about the size of a quarter, but they have really bad paralysis toxins, and you might end up in the hospital dealing with sort of extreme pain from these really small jellies. And we know that they're sort of really abundant all the way from the Metida conch, and this last summer we found them all the way down in the Forked River Lagoon area.
And while the real way we will reduce their populations is by using more green infrastructure and eliminating things like stormwater pollution, there's one immediate thing we can do to interrupt their part of their life cycle, where they're cloning and multiplying on PVC bulkheads.
So we're really excited because we're partnering with the one and only Berkeley Township Underwater Search and Rescue Squad. BTUSAR is a nonprofit, all-volunteer, public safety scuba diving team that has very unique skills as well as equipment to help us in our collective mission. Here to share more about their operations and procedures, we have Chief Greg Elliott and the president of the organization, Carl Maddox.
Hello, my name is Gregory Elliott. I'm the chief of Berkeley Township Underwater Search and Rescue.
And I'm Carl. Carl Maddox, the president of BTUSAR.
Thank you guys for being here. Can you start off by explaining a little bit about the dive team and its position in the community and its origin?
Well, yeah, let me take that because I've been here just slightly longer than you, Greg.
Ha.
So I joined the team in 2005. This was many years because after the team was formed in 1976, many years of searching and rescuing were taking place. When I joined, they had a building and they had lots of training focused on searching and recovering and rescuing things that fall in the water. And they also had a nice little truck and they had a couple of nice little boats. Many things have changed since then. And especially for the jellyfish project, which is a thing we're working on right now.
So we have run headlong into this jellyfish project. We were graciously granted by the state DEP. But it all started a couple of years back, before this grant ever even really was, anyone was thinking about it. We were asked to come up with a way to scrub bulkheads to try to disrupt jellyfish polyps at a larval stage in their life cycle. And we took it as a challenge, like we do with many of the phone calls we get. And we kind of came up with a rough system involving a trash pump and a pool scrubber and a bunch of hoses. And we made something that worked, but, you know, kind of in a rudimentary way. The DP was plenty happy with it. A couple years go by, and we had the opportunity to really go back at this project with a little more resources and a lot more help from a couple other partner organizations. And now we've been able to master our task, and we've built a whole lot more equipment, and we've began to try to do this task at scale. So we have a couple boats that we've made, purpose-built for the individual tasks that they're going to do. And we've outfitted them with equipment for those tasks. The most charming of all of them being the mud bugs. They're originally Mark II BEBs that came from the Army dive program. They were combat support craft for the military, used to make field expedient bridges across bodies of water. But we turned them into floating work platforms. They're kind of rectangular. They look like a little like a barge, but they got jet drives, big 6-inch jet drives, and they're meant for moving heavy stuff around. So they got no problem moving people. What we do is we pack them full of workers and equipment, and we bring them out, and those are the actual vessels that we do the disruption of the polyps, if you will, otherwise known as scrubbing. On them, we'll put a crew of people and we outfit them with brushes and power washers, and we go after the individual sites.
I should mention that all those workers and all the building of the boats and the special equipment, it's been done by volunteers. We are a total volunteer organization.
Yeah, along with coming up with this equipment, it's been teaching people how to use it and use it safely. Being a public safety dive team, we get the opportunity to find ourselves in many unique positions. And this is just another one of those. And we love the challenge. It's always a good time to, let alone build our own gear, but go out and solve a problem that maybe nobody else is doing.
So the really exciting thing is that Saturday, for the first time in this grant cycle, we're getting to go out and be shovel in the ground or rush to the bulkhead, as we were saying earlier. So, I mean, if you can talk a little bit about what's going to happen on Saturday.
Let me build a picture for you. So all of you listening in, we pull up to the bulkhead, and you'll see a funny looking square boat with a white tower. And we'll set up and we'll be pinning the boat in place with our homemade, we call them spuds. They're pole anchors that'll hold the boat in place so we don't have to rig to anybody's docks or bulkheads and worry about touching any of their stuff. And we can distance ourselves away from the bulkhead to make a space for our divers to work. And we'll begin setting up our equipment. We'll send a diver or two in and they'll begin a preliminary inspection of the bulkhead. Checking it, making sure that the bulkhead isn't already damaged or in a way that we would be doing anything worse to it by trying to scrub these polyps off. And then after it passes its preliminary inspection, we'll send our divers in and they'll begin scrubbing and power washing bulkheads, floating jet ski docks, floating docks, anything in and around the property that could harbor jellyfish polyps.
They didn't do too well when they tried to nest in wooden bulkheads that were full of tar and other protective material because clearly it's a toxic environment. So they're quite happy to live on plastic bulkheads and plastic floating docks. And that's where we have to go disturb the nesting or settling, right?
Yeah, that's actually part of the theory here is with the increase in square footage of vinyl bulkheads in the bay that we saw an increase in jellyfish. So a part of this project is while we're focusing on the vinyl bulkheads, trying to do enough physical disruption of enough square footage that we can see a change in the jellyfish population in the bay. Not that we're scared of messing with wood bulkheads, but they're not exactly our primary target.
We'll be doing this for 3 years. So 3 years of scrubbing and analysis of the jellyfish population in the area that we focused on.
Quite a big task when you really step back and look at it, but it's a cool challenge. We've never shied away from any help anyone's ever needed, and this won't be an exception.
Well, we thank you guys for your service, and we can't wait to see everything that takes place on Saturday.
Really, thanks for having us.
If there's one thing the dive team can do, it's talk. Thanks for having us. This is Chief Greg Elliott.
And I'm Kyle Mattox.
We'll see you out on the water.
Yes, be safe.
So we're really excited about this upcoming scrubbing initiative that we're doing with the Berkeley Underwater Search and Rescue Team. And we're excited for the next phase of this project and taking this forward. So Dr. Bologna, would you be able to explain how we'll know if any of this will work?
So we've got a couple of different aspects that we're looking at. And in particular, the idea with the scrubbing is that they're going to disrupt that part of the life cycle of the jellyfish. So we're going to get rid of those polyps. We're kind of going to destroy them. We have two mechanisms to kind of look at that. First is, are there a lot of jellyfish next year? So we're going to be doing sampling in the water areas where the dock scrubbings and the bulkhead scrubbings have been going on to look at it from sort of a holistic approach. But in addition to that, we use DNA. We use environmental DNA to try to understand what's really going on there. So we actually take sort of long Q-tips and we swab the underside of the decks before they begin the scrub to sort of identify whether or not there's jellyfish DNA there. We take that back into the lab. My colleague Jack Gaynor is the molecular biologist on this, and he actually analyzes it for the presence of bay nettle DNA. We will go back then after the scrubbing's done in the next spring, and we will swab those same docks that have been scrubbed. And we'll see whether or not there's DNA. If there is, then that might not be as good as we thought. If there's no DNA, then we know that we disrupted that life cycle and we're going to see fewer jellies in the following years.
So that's pretty cool that we're on the precipice of this really fascinating science that's happening. And we are lucky to really have the dream team here working on this project. But considering how dynamic the issue of jellyfish in our bay is, we know that listeners are probably most concerned with how they can get involved with this project. So don't worry about that, because we have plenty for all of you that you can do.
So some of the ways to be involved or to kind of follow the work that I do is you can follow me on Twitter, which is Dr. Jellyfish. And that'll give you sort of a line of what we do when we're out in the field and some things that are going on. And then you can also join the New Jersey Jelly Spotters Facebook page. And in that case, that gets you an opportunity to show us the pictures of your jellies. And we try to do a lot of identifications and help identify what the public is seeing there. But it allows us to give us alerts to what's going on in the water when we see things. For example, just a couple of weeks ago, we had Caribbean box jellies showing up along the coast of the New Jersey shoreline. These are considerably more dangerous species of jellies that seemingly come in the afternoons or in the fall. And at that point, you know, there's a little bit more danger that you need to be concerned about in the water. So we try to post those things to keep the public understanding and interested, but it's also a great way to link in with all of the projects that we're involved with.
Yeah, I think the key thing overall is like awareness of the bay nettles or jellyfish in general. I think if people are more aware of where there's high numbers of them and that information gets back, there's a better chance that we can look at some of those parameters that kind of drive their existence. And that's something that we could kind of address, because the one thing about these bay nettles or jellyfish or, you know, whatever you want to call them, is that they have to go through a life cycle, and to kind of stem them at the beginning of that life cycle may be easier than to try to corral them all up as adults. That becomes a little bit more intensive and probably improbable that that could happen. We can kind of look at structures or whatever other type of features that would be more advantageous for them to settle on, you know, as they go through their life stages.
Well, of course, the first thing to do is reduce the amount of lawn fertilizer we use throughout towns surrounding Barnegat Bay, as well as eliminate other pollutants such as dog and waste pesticides. If you are a resident in one of the three focus towns, you can email me at jellyfish@savebarnegatbay.org to stay up to date on when we might be coming to your lagoon in Toms River, Brook, or Berkeley. If you are not in those three towns, feel free to go ahead and scrub your bulkhead in winter months when the adult jellyfish have finished reproducing. If you are curious to see what might be growing on your bulkhead, you can sign up for our settling plate program. We upcycled extra plastic from our rain barrel program, hung it on some fishing line, and made it so that you can hang the little string of plastic plates on your piling in the water and see what's growing on it. This spring, we will invite you all to our next Jellyfish Observation Day, where we look at the settling plates under microscopes, talk to scientists, and hear from a speaker. We held two of these events already. You can catch Paul's talk about jellyfish on our YouTube channel, as well as Greg and Carl's talk about dive team's part in a different video, also on YouTube.
You can come to our Meet the Author event on November 22nd to meet Julie Burwald, the author of Spineless, a book all about jellyfish across the planet and how they're moving into different spaces and causing us all kinds of problems. Don't forget to get on our mailing list and follow our socials for updates. If you want to learn more about the jellyfish in Barnegat Bay and how we can slow their population, you can invite Brittany to do an educational program for your community group. Our website has a ton of information about this project, so click the word educate at the top of our website and then go to Stop the Sting.
So this Saturday will be the first time this team heads out to scrub bulkheads in Berkeley. We expect to learn a lot from this process and only keep improving it as we go. This winter, we are focusing on Berkeley Shores Lagoons, given it is the hometown of the dive team, but next winter, we will be able to move into the other two towns.
So thank you all so much for taking the time to introduce yourselves to our listeners, and thank you to all of our listeners for joining us here. We're excited to be sharing this project with you all, if you couldn't tell.
Well, thank you, and thank you for listening. This is John Wenick from the Marine Academy of Technology and Environmental Science and Research Coordinator for the Save Barnegat Bay Student Grant Program run during the summer. Thank you.
And so take care, and the Jellyfish Man is out.
Well, we all have our work cut out for us as per usual here at Save Barnegat Bay. I just want to give a shout out to our dedicated interns that worked under Brittany for this project. Emily, Eric, Kenichi, Alyssa, John for working on this project since the spring of last year and really helping us get so much done to educate and coordinate about jellyfish. So don't forget to follow the podcast so you're notified of new episodes. We look forward to hearing your feedback.
Until next time, we'll see you later.
Bye. Bye.